Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we grapple with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Happy Tuesday, Elizabeth. What's on your mind today?
My music sounds good today. Let's see what's on my mind today. Well, I want to talk about depression in the most positive of ways. I've been doing a lot of thinking about all of the research and writings that have come up lately. We tend to have these, kind of cycles, these ebbs and flows about depression in the media or in our professional journals or in our conversations about mental health, our whole understanding of depression, our conversations about depression, how to treat depression, what is the genesis of depression. It kind of comes in and out of the conversations in fits and spurts. I don't know if that's the right word, throughout the year. And it seems like right now in the last 6 months or so, there's been a lot of discussion that's come up, at least in the places that I go to look for information, the articles that I read, the journals that I follow, a lot of talk about treatment of depression has come to the forefront. And so I thought, why not talk about it now? Because spring has sprung. So we're in the time of year where for a lot of people, they start to feel rejuvenated and hopeful and looking forward to the warmer weather and new life and all those things that the spring equinox kind of puts into motion. And so it feels like a safe time to talk about depression, because if you're someone who struggles with seasonal affective disorder or periodic depression or episodic depressive disorders, they tend to lift most often in the spring and summer. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, although for most people, many people who have episodic experiences with depression that they lift in the spring, there's another group of people that actually, when spring comes around, they start to experience episodic depression, which is kind of an underserved and not really talked about area of depression, because it doesn't fall under the seasonal affective disorder description, and it doesn't really connect to something that we would attach to depression, like dark long days and heavy moods and periods of being stuck indoors. And so this idea of the spring fever, we call it spring fever, mm-hmm. Because it's associated with this high energy and new excitement about life. But actually, there's an essence of spring fever that's connected to a whole depressive disorder.
I have to wonder if that actually applies to me. I tend to find that around spring a little bit sometimes. My mood drops.
Yeah, so you get spring fever in a way that we don't generally talk about. And it can be this like heightened sense of sensitivity to all things going around. Our filters start to change. But for the conversation about depression today, I want to talk about the language of depression and how we define depression and how we've seen for the last 50 years conversations about depression and society and isolation and the dehumanizing of the individual's experience, and that this trend that with 40 years of Prozac on the market, almost 40 years of Prozac on the market, we've seen an exponential rise in depression in society. And so this ongoing conversation, conflict, debate as to whether depression is a medical disease or a situational disorder kind of goes on and on when you talk about the tools that we've used for the last 40, 50 years, like medications primarily, not having the impact that was hoped for, and yet really not knowing which direction to turn, what to do when people are struggling and suffering and feeling hopeless. And although these medications had promised to be the savior, the reversal of depression, it really hasn't lived up to it. So I kind of wanted to explore the idea of vocabulary or definitions and see how language impacts our mental health, because how we talk about something can give it power. You know, how we discuss our lives, if we talk about our lives from this positive view, you know, we look at the things that we have going for us and feel positive about it, you know, that whole positive self-talk
really can have an effect on our mood and our energy and our anxiety levels. How we talk about our marriages, how we talk about our children, how we view our bodies. You know, the language that we use to describe our life has a huge impact in how we live our lives. And we tend to overlook the power of language when it comes to depression because for the last 50 years or so, the field of psychiatry has worked really hard to portray depression as a disease of the brain instead of an illness of the mind, which is a very different way of looking at depression, both centered around the same area of the human being, but very different ways of understanding how it affects us. Because if we see depression as a disease of the brain, then we would think that pills, medications would heal the brain. But they're not. And even though this idea was put out there to the world in the late 60s, that there was a connection between the brain and depression, and that it was a chemical imbalance that was somehow causing people to become depressed. Although this was floated out in academic papers and quickly kind of grasped onto as an ideal, it's never been proven to be true. The story keeps being told in many different ways, but it's never been quintessentially proven to be true that there is a direct link between chemical imbalance and depression. Now, it doesn't mean that the brain doesn't become altered in some ways, or their hormones are released in different ways, or there are chemicals that change when we've experienced trauma or loss or anything that would trigger depression. There are changes that happen, but it's the chicken and the egg sort of thing, the order of how these things happen. You know, the idea that this disease comes over our brain and then we become depressed has never been proven, but the idea that when we are experiencing depressive episodes, our brain chemistry changes makes a lot more sense. And it's interesting to look back and how we kind of got to this place of looking at depression as a disease of the brain, because it's not really accidental, and it's also not strictly scientific. There is a progression of social changes that happened in our language around depression and mental health that kind of got us to this place. And back in, again, as I mentioned, in the 60s is when we started looking at academic papers that started kind of throwing out this idea that there was a chemical imbalance theory. But also that was happening was there was a political effort to notice that social conditions had a direct contribution to mental health. Things like poverty, unemployment, racial discrimination, housing conditions. These social conditions had a direct impact on people's mental health and well-being, that there were higher rates of depression and anxiety and helplessness and hopelessness in populations of people who were struggling in unhealthy social conditions. And what's interesting that they focused on those negative social conditions, you know, poverty, unemployment, racial discrimination, but there was also connections at the time that people who lived in great wealth and great privilege also struggled from their social conditions of privilege from these experiences of depression or anxiety, that having too much or too little can also set up that same sense of imbalance. But the focus politically was on trying to make the connection between social conditions and mental health. But the National Institute of Mental Health abandoned their research on the social causes of depression under President Richard Nixon, because at the time, the idea of biologically based approaches towards depression were much more politically palatable to this very conservative administration. It was much easier to kind of grasp onto the idea of a biologically based approach to mental health than to have to address the social conditions that could be driving mental health conditions. But then you speed ahead to 2016 and a recent article that was written actually in Liverpool, England, by a psychiatrist there. He came out last year with a scathing article. His name is Dr. Peter Kinderman. And he came out with a scathing article talking about mental illness and that it's largely caused by social crises such as unemployment or childhood abuse or trauma, and that too much money was being spent researching genetic biological factors years, and no money was going to look at the social crises or trauma or childhood abuse and how it was impacting the population. And he said in the article that although there's been some success in uncovering genes which make people more susceptible to various disorders, it hasn't got to the true cause of depression or anxiety because they really come from life events and the environments in which people live, and that more research needs to be directed towards understanding the everyday triggers instead of trying to make connections and uncovering the genes that might be affected by these traumas. Dr. Kinderman says, you know, every single action, every emotion we have involves the brain in some way. So having a piece of scientific research telling us that the brain is involved in responding to events doesn't really advance our understanding much of depression or anxiety. And it actually detracts from the fact that when unemployment rates go up in a particular area, you see measurable increases in suicide. It also detracts from the idea that trauma in childhood is a powerful indicator and predictor of serious problems in adult life. So here back in the 60s, we had this understanding that there was a connection between our social issues, our environmental factors, our childhood traumas, and our mental health throughout our life. And yet, just by changing the language and the shift of our political energy towards this idea of a biologically based approach to mental health, we completely disbanded the research that was being done to help change those social conditions that might actually have reduced our mental health crisis over the last 50 years instead of what we have seen is an increase. And so now the talk comes up again. It only took 50 years of going backwards in a negative direction to have us start readdressing this idea of the holistic causes of mental health issues such as depression and anxiety and phobias and social anxiety. So that's one piece of it. You know, how do we right the ship of our mental health profession? And it's an industry. So we could have had this understanding that, look, it was a great run through the world of biologically based depression, but it didn't pan out to be true in the way we needed it or hoped it would be. And medications really aren't working to the extent that we hoped they would. So let's turn directions and start treating mental health issues like depression in ways that we know would be helpful, like addressing societal issues. But you can't change the direction of an entire industry that quickly. You know, the mental health industry is a huge behemoth. It's a Titanic. And the American Psychiatric Association didn't even recognize their, I'm not going to say mistake, but their direction until 2013. So it wasn't until 2013 at the American Psychiatric Conference that someone came out and said, we may be moving in the wrong direction. We may be overdiagnosing depression and other psychiatric illnesses when really it's societal factors and life events that are triggering this. In 1998, so we're talking 20 years ago, Dr. Martin Seligman, who is the president of the American Psychological Association, spoke at a conference and said there is now 10 to 20 times more depression diagnosed than there was 50 years ago, which would have been in 1948. And it's become not just a problem of adults, but it's become a young person's problem. We used to see the onset of depression diagnosis at the age of around 29 and a half. But in 1998, the average age of diagnosing depression was between 14 and 15. And in 2011, antidepressant use had increased by 400% in just two decades. It's the most frequently used medication in those ages 18 to 44. And by 1998, 23% of women ages 40 to 59 were on an antidepressant. The reason that's frightening is because antidepressants, when they don't work, can actually cause long-term negative effects. And I'm trying to find, there was an article, I'll come back to that. I just want to say that in 1998, when Seligman came out and made that statement, there was a lot of alarms that started going up, that people started noticing that we were going in the wrong direction and in, you know, treating depression and recognizing when people are struggling. So here's just a few of the books that came out in rapid succession from 1998. Paula Kaplan wrote They Say You're Crazy. Herb Cutchins and Stuart Kirks wrote Making Us Crazy. Alan Horowitz and Jeremy Wakefields wrote The Loss of Sadness, How Psychiatry Transformed Normal Sorrow into Depressive Disorder. And Christopher Lanes wrote Shyness, How Normal Behavior Became a Sickness. Charles Barber, a book that I've referenced often in over the years during the show, wrote Comfortably Numb, How Psychiatry is Medicating a Nation. And most recently, Alan Francis, who was one of the psychiatrists on the DSM, Diagnostic Statistical Manual Task Force of the DSM-4, he came out after this DSM-5 was written and wrote Saving Normal out of his concern that, you know, we've gone from having 120 original diagnoses in the very first, 106 diagnoses in the first DSM in 1952. And by the DSM-5, we have 365 different potential disorders that people can be diagnosed with. And his book, Saving Normal, stated that 69% of those who are on the task force writing the DSM, which is the Bible that determines our mental wellness, 69% of them had direct ties to the pharmaceutical industry. All of this information about language and depression and vocabulary and the political influence of pharmaceuticals and even politicians in advancing different ideas that benefit the pharmaceutical companies or those who are pushing different types of treatments, none of this has brought us any closer to alleviating the things that were most challenging to us as a people, beginning with the Industrial Revolution, beginning at the turn of the 20th century. And this idea of depression isn't new. Every culture, every society, every civilization has struggled with depression. And somehow, if you read any of Shakespeare's works or any of the Greek mythologies or old, you know, writings, there have been references to depression and to depressive episodes and going into these dark spaces and living in the underground or in the underworld. Depression has lived in humankind since the beginning of humankind. The symptoms, the way it's talked about, are the same, but it's how we have addressed it as a society that has shifted generation after generation after generation until we've gotten to this point where we're sicker than ever before. So that was a long introduction to a conversation or a subject that maybe is too big for 1 hour, but I want to see what you have to say about depression. What is it that you think about when you hear the word depression? Does it frighten you? Because words have power, and the word depression has a lot of power in our society today. People fear it. People fear that diagnosis. They fear the feelings of hopelessness or sadness that are indicators of depression because the treatments are not perfect and long-standing and maybe pose more trouble than they are going to be healing. So where are you in this conversation of depression in the world? I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, our number is 805-781-3875. You can also find us on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist. You can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org under the News Talk tab. And you can podcast our show by checking out Apple Podcasts and subscribing to our conversation. And we'll be back to continue this conversation. Seems to fit. Hanging around, nothing to do but frown. Rainy days and Mondays always get me down. What I've got, they used to call the blues. Nothing is really wrong. Feeling like I don't belong. Walking around some kind of lonely clown. Rainy days and Mondays always get me down. Funny I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And I started off today talking about depression and how we talk about something that gives it power. Maybe we aren't biologically sicker at this time in history than we ever were before. Depression has been a part of the human story since the beginning of man. But maybe it's our belief that progress in the modern world would make our lives far happier or easier, which has increased our expectations that life should be more satisfying. And that actually is resulting in a mass disappointment that everyone is feeling. Because life has always been hard. It's been far harder to make a living and to survive and to actually, you know, overcome the elements in worlds behind us. It's much easier today. So maybe we've just gotten too soft. Maybe our expectations are too high. Maybe we've just been told that anything that isn't pure joy and happiness is an illness. But what if we switched that around? Like, what if the truth was that we kind of live in this low-level depression all the time, that we our normal is kind of this atypical depression that is underneath the surface, this kind of sadness that we feel, and that those moments of joy or periods of awe or periods of excitement or ecstasy are really the abnormal? How would you live differently if that were true? If we were to say, hey, your day-to-day is kind of this atypical low-level depression, but if you're lucky enough, you'll go through long periods of time of episodic happiness and episodic joy. How would that change how we treated depression? Would we treat it at all? 805-781-3875. Hi, Chelsea, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi, I found this topic really interesting because I actually just had a run-in with a doctor about this same topic. They tried to put me on antidepressants for depression and anxiety, and I just find it interesting that the pharmaceutical companies are so quick to diagnose you and treat you with some chemical imbalance that's going to mess with your brain, but they don't actually want to connect you with someone or something that's going to actually solve your problems long term. And I just think it's ridiculous because this depression topic is so taboo to people, especially doctors, the people that are there to help you. And I wanted to say that I appreciate this conversation because not a lot of people are talking about it.
Well, I think it's a scary thing to talk about, Chelsea, because the medical industry is so deeply attached to it. And who are we to speak out against experts, right? That starts to become this wall of they must know more than we do. So how can we question it? Which is why I like to go back into all of this research and say, prove to me, show me where there is the proof that there is a biologically based connection to depression. And I might believe the story more, but we have no biological, factual connection between the two. If SSRIs, if lifting our serotonin was going to biologically lift depression, then the SSRIs should work every single time. But clearly it is not a chemical imbalance. So what do you do?
I think that in order to answer that too, like, we are the ones that are living with that though.
Mm-hmm.
We're not the ones that are coming up with these chemicals that are trying to treat this stuff. Like, they're not, it's almost like the pharmaceutical companies or the people that are prescribing these medications aren't actually looking into what the human populace is living with. Mm-hmm. They're just, you know, like blindly saying, oh, this might help you, so we're going to give this to you. And then if it doesn't work, we can try a different one. They don't have any other approach. And it's just, like, where is the research saying that all of these chemicals are actually going to help you long term? It's just not there.
No, and conversely, actually, the research shows that quite often people start, if they are prescribed a drug for a low-level or mid-level depression experience, an antidepressant, it actually can cause longer-term, more chronic problems down the road, that taking this and altering our chemicals in our brain through this antidepressant could trigger a manic event, which could lead us to being diagnosed with bipolar disorder. I mean, that's what they're showing more often with the use of these chemical interventions. And as
well,
I mentioned,
that to me, sorry to cut you off. That to me is more scary than talking about depression itself, mm-hmm. and how to either cope with it in a holistic way or actually trying to find research that's going to dive deeper into the topic and actually try to solve it and help these people in a way that's going to make their symptoms either go away or help them cope with it longer term, instead of just like spinning them even deeper down a rabbit hole, you know?
I understand. And I do think that one of the reasons we don't go down that road is because if depression is closely tied to social conditions like poverty, unemployment, stress, destruction of the environment, those are much more difficult things to address than just assigning medications to individual people.
And I think, right, I completely agree.
And I think that's the rabbit hole we're in right now, is that we're trying to band-aid the symptoms of a massive amount of people who are actually reacting normally to the sickness of the culture they're trying to adapt to.
Well, I would even say social media is part of that band-aid too, because social media, it's not even out there on those platforms either. And it's just another way for people to break their focus on something that's less important or less crucial to their actual health.
Right.
And I think that having people like you talking about this on a public radio platform is what we need in order to make a stride in the right direction, in a more positive direction, instead of the negative one that we've been in for so long.
Thank you, Chelsea. And I do think it is a bit of the, if we can get people concerned about themselves, if we can convince people that they're fundamentally sick, they won't feel empowered to speak out because they'll think they're broken. And that's been very effective to point out people who feel passionate about something as being fanatical. And then it disempowers them. And
totally,
that's what we
see. Because
now
we're being told that it's not okay to talk about it because it's something that's bad or it's something that has negative repercussions, and that you have to deal with it in a way that's more silent. And at this point, I'm really tired of being silent about depression and anxiety. I think that it's a very prevalent thing that's going on, and more people need to actually be upfront with themselves, but also be upfront with their provider and tell them, no, like, I'm not taking this medication because it's going to mess with my brain, and I'm not willing to sacrifice my long-term health for your medication that you're being paid to sell me right now.
I appreciate your powerful words, Chelsea. Thank you for calling in.
Thank you so much.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And if you'd like to be part of the conversation, our number is 805-781-3875. I understand it's a scary thing to talk about. Sometimes we fear talking about depression because maybe we'll catch it, or maybe if we talk about it, we'll bring it to us. You know, anything that seems to have so much power, the world of depression is dark. The world of depression is messy and ugly and frightening. You know, it takes away our day-to-day enjoyment of our lives. Depression is a serious physical and emotional experience. But I'm also wondering how we can change the vocabulary, our understanding of depression, and actually take some power back. What if, as I mentioned before, what if depression, that low-level depression, is actually a normal response to all of the heavy social conditions that we deal with on a daily basis? That life is challenging, that we are living in debt, that we have kids that are in debt, that we have economic and political unrest and environmental unrest. Maybe that low-level depression is normal, and that if we have episodic experiences of joy and happiness, that is actually abnormal, but a joyful abnormal. You know, how would that change how we treated our lives or treated the people that had depression? You know, why is it that women are diagnosed with depression at much higher levels than men are? At any period of time, 1/3 of all women can be diagnosed with depression. And, you know, when we look at what impacts, you know, depression, how depression becomes a part of our life, there are many factors. One is our temperament or personality can impact whether we have a propensity towards depression. Our life conditions, our life experiences, childhood trauma or abuse has a huge impact in depression down the road. There is a small genetic component, but it is a small component, but it is there. And there are some that argue that it's not maybe as much genetics that impact depression being passed down, but it's growing up in a house with a depressed parent can pass down and model that behavior of depression. So we have our genetics a little bit. We have our temperament, our personality. We have our social and environmental influences that all impact it. But the biggest one is, how do we as a culture address depression and talk about it? 805-781-3875. Hi, Sharon. What's on your mind?
Hi.
Hi.
I was interested in your experience, since you've been in this line of work, so to speak, for so long. I'm just wondering if you see, you know, clusters of people with depression that are maybe more type A, or if there's anything about, I tend to be someone who's very observant, mm-hmm. and I notice a lot of things that are wrong. Mm-hmm. And so many people think that that's really being negative. And to me, it's just noticing things. It's not really complaining.
Well, and there's different terms, but one of the terms we use is HSP, highly sensitive people or highly sensitized people. And they're ones whose filters seem to be a little more open. And so you take things in and you notice things all around you. And so you can experience joy in high levels, but then you also feel the negatives in high levels, that highly sensitized person. There are people's temperaments. Some people are optimists. Some people are pessimists. If you look at the works of great authors and artists, they tend to have a more dark or depressive mood or temperament than those who, you know, are more optimistic or kind of born with the temperament to see the sunny side. So that there are those things that are involved. The struggle is that we at some point decided to start labeling and parsing out good and bad personality types or good and bad temperaments. And then once we started doing that, we had labels and diagnoses and ways of labeling people as sick or healthy.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. That's kind of what I was thinking, is it's gotten to be where you're definitely labeled as depressive if you aren't upbeat about everything. Well, look around the world. There's plenty of things to be stressed out about, your own personal life and the micro and the macro. And I think it's really disingenuous at best to act like, oh, you know, chin up and everything's not that bad. It is kind of bad on a number of levels, even if you're not personally. Like, I know a couple people, including myself, that feel like we can't beat all that up if we know that there's a lot of injustices around the world for other people, and we can't fix it and help it in a direct way. But we feel their pain, and it's almost like bearing witness to the injustices to at least notice them.
And Sharon, I think that's why the other level of this is our communities. And one of the big changes, because the question I kind of laid out there is, why in the last 50 years, when we've taken a concerted, you know, look at depression and tried to treat it, have people become more depressed? And if you look at over this period of time, last 50 years, people have become actually more isolated and more disconnected from community, more disconnected from each other. And so at one time where someone like yourself, who might be more sensitive and see things in a more, you know, negative or realistic light, had the balance of their friends that they spent time with who are the more upbeat, right? You maybe were in a bowling league or went out to play bridge, or you're in a community activism group. Those things have all gone away primarily. And so we have so many people that are isolated in their own lives that it's difficult to find any balance. So then the levels of depression that a depressed person might feel have become deeper and stronger. We don't have that ebb and flow of time in the community and time to be reflective.
Agreed, for sure. And I just want to say, we love your program out here, and really appreciate you doing all the topics and just being there.
Thank you,
Sharon. You're such a nice, calm voice and very supportive, and it's really appreciated.
Oh, Sharon, thank you for taking the time to call. I appreciate that. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. Our number is 805-781-3875. We'll be back to take your calls and to continue this conversation.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again, because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping, vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence. In restless dreams I walked alone.
You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And Cecilia, you're on the air. What's on your mind today?
Hi, yes. I'd like to know your opinion of a cognitive behavioral therapy, a Feeling Good therapy book by Ken Burns.
Mm-hmm. Have you participated in CBT before?
Yes, I have. I am bipolar, and I am on antidepressants, and I'm on mood stabilizers. However, the theory behind the cognitive behavioral therapy is to change your thinking.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, that the myth that you're depressed because you want secondary gain, you want people to feel sorry for you. Or how to overcome black and white thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And the other idea that really has helped me is the idea of fortune telling. You worry, what's going to happen, what's going to happen, when there's really nothing you can do about it.
So you have to let it go.
Except right now. What can I do about it right now? And the other thing is mind reading. Oh, what is he going to say? What is he, you know, that kind of thinking. So the theory behind what I think is the cognitive behavioral therapy is to change your thinking about something. And if you change your thinking about something, you may be able to change your behavior.
Right.
You may not be able to change the social and economic situation that you're in, but you may be able to change how you approach it and how you can change your behavior. It gives, what I felt was that it gave me some empowerment. And I think I have these thoughts and feelings beyond my chemical, like you were making the separation between chemical brain therapy. And I believe there is also this other level where we are the human being above and beyond whatever chemistry is going on.
Well, and I appreciate, you know, that you've had success with this, because CBT actually has the highest rate of success in dealing with talk therapy and, you know, helping people with depression and with OCD, you know, with different phobias, because it
yes.
does engage the brain. It does start, you know, helping us to rewire our thinking patterns.
Right.
We get stuck in kind of this rutted style of thinking. So the fact that you have success is the most important, because the bottom line with all of our treatments is that you have to keep working towards your healing till you find something that works for you. The
right.
whole struggle with dealing with depression is that there isn't a mainline course of action that helps every person. And that's why medications become the default, because at least it's a something.
Right.
And everything else takes a lot of work, because what you're talking about with cognitive behavioral therapy, it's not passive. You have to take charge of your life every day. You have to
exactly.
take charge of the thinking. And a lot of people, frankly, don't have that energy. And on one hand, it's one reason why medications in a very short term would be helpful, because if it can reduce symptoms enough so that you have the energy to do the CBT or the self-help, work on your eating and your exercise and your journaling and your breathing, then you can get off the meds and go back
right.
to your life. The problem is we don't have enough faith in the long-term healing to stick with it. And that's one of the problems, is that when people don't feel like they're getting results quickly enough, they give up on it and go back. But going back to this whole idea, if we rethought how we believe depression works, how would it change the way we worked with it? What if depression actually has a evolutionary, a biologically important role in our lives? What if depression is a signal to us from our psyche that something needs to change? What if we're missing completely the whole benefit of depression in our growth as human beings? And what we're doing is trying to take away the symptoms of something that is desperately trying to be expressed through our psyche. And that if we actually, instead of trying to eliminate depression and eliminate the symptoms, instead we went into the depression and tried to understand what it was we needed to address, we might actually become whole and heal and move forward with our lives. Maybe there are periods of depression that we need to go through in our lives in order to actually grow. And one of the people that really inspired my thoughts on this are Dr. Neil Burton. I listened to a talk that he did a year ago about this idea of the depressive position. And he just flipped my mind on this idea of what biologically or evolutionary depression was for us. So if we have it ready to go, Tyler, let's just listen to a little bit of what Dr. Neil Burton had to say about the depressive position.
Just as physical pain has evolved to signal injury and to prevent further injury, so the depressive position may have evolved to remove us from damaging, distressing, or futile situations. The time and space and solitude that the adoption of a depressive position affords prevents us from making rash decisions, enables us to see the bigger picture, and in the context of being a social animal, to reassess our social relationships, think about those who are meaningful to us, and relate to them more meaningfully and with greater compassion. In other words, the depressive position may have evolved as a signal that something is seriously wrong and needs working through and changing, or at least processing and understanding. Sometimes we can become so immersed in the humdrum of our everyday lives that we no longer have time to think and feel about ourselves, and so lose sight of our bigger picture. The adoption of the depressive position can force us to cast off the Pollyannish optimism and rose-tinted spectacles that shield us from reality, to take a step back, to reevaluate our priorities, and to formulate a realistic, although modest, plan for fulfilling them.
So that's Dr. Neil Burton, and you can find his talk on YouTube about depressive position, but because it goes on from there. But what if we flip it all? What if what we understand about depression is completely wrong? How would you deal with it if you understood that it was trying to help you in some fundamental way to grow or to heal or to uncover parts of yourself that you haven't been paying attention to? 805-781-3875 is our number. Yael?
Yes.
Could you pronounce your name for me? I'm sorry.
Yael.
What is on your mind today?
Well, I actually was listening to the clip and to the talk so far, and there's a lot of things I agree with, but I just want to bring up the situation where depression can be life-threatening, mm-hmm. just like a cancer is life-threatening. So there are physical illnesses that tell us that something is wrong, and I agree, and we have to change. If we have a cold, maybe we don't eat well. Maybe we are run down. We can take more vitamins. But there are certain illnesses physically that we have to resort to very very particular treatments, such as in cancer, such as in other illnesses. And part of depression is what's happening in the brain. You know, when we feel bad, something is going in our brain. There is chemicals running around and doing all kind of a havoc thing. I mean, you can compare it to an autoimmune disease when the immune system is overreacting. You know, that it's doing what immune system is supposed to be doing, but it's out of hand. And I know it's not a very correct comparison, but the brain, we don't just have a bad day, okay? When the guy was talking, it's like, you're having a bad day, look at yourself, see what you can do, talk to some people. For some people, that's not what depression is. Depression can be life-threatening, and without a proper medication, which is very difficult to assess and to fit, I realize that there is the knowledge about depression is way, way behind. It's not like cancer or other diseases, but it's worth the trying so that the person, like the lady that spoke before me said, it allows you at least to be alive and to handle yourself enough so that you can look and try to figure out how to live your life and what is wrong with you, rather than just, you know, be completely incapacitated. So I just think that the audience should, the listener should know that sometimes it's imperative to continue the medication, to look for something good, not to stop taking medication. It can be very, very seriously dangerous.
Thank you. And I definitely don't want to give the impression that I'm saying stop taking medications. If you're on medications, you absolutely cannot stop cold turkey. If you have been on medications for any period of time for antidepressants or anxiety or any mood disorder, if you wanted to go off of them, you need to go off of them under medical supervision. It's why you should think long and hard before you go on them, because they are not a medication that you can just stop taking, because it would have serious implications to your health. And that is very, very true. But I will go back to this argument about the difference between depression being a disease of the brain. It's not a disease of the brain. That hasn't been proven. And that was the point of the talk from the beginning of my show today, is that it's this idea that it's a disease of the brain, like cancer or diabetes, was something that was floated starting back in the 60s, but has never been proven. What we do see, it's not a chemical imbalance. Things change in our brain as a result of depression, but there's not just a switch that goes off and people become depressed, a disease of the brain. Instead, the idea that we talked about today is looking at depression as an illness of the mind. And if it's an illness of the mind that affects our mood, affects our behavior, affects our health, and it can become chronic and life-threatening, then by all means, we have to do whatever we can to get a hold of our lives. And if that means medication for a period of time, absolutely. But my thesis today is, how can we rethink what depression is in society? Because it's a social construct. This idea that depression is a biologically based disease is incorrect, and it's led to 50 years of a population getting more and more ill. And we need to switch the way we look at depression and how we talk about depression and how we address what the causes of depression are. So that's, you know, that's really what I'm hoping we do, is to chip away at this kind of rooted idea. As long as we hang on to this idea that it's a disease of the brain, it's going to be very, very difficult to see our way out of depression, the epidemic of depression in our culture. Hi, Bonnie, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi. I just wanted to add my experience in dealing with depression, and being put on one antidepressant after another and none of them working, and the feeling that I ended up having, like, there's something wrong with me, when in fact, you know, and that I'm a failure. I mean, it just took me down even further. Mm-hmm. When in fact, finally getting into a group of peers, mm-hmm. people that I found out that I wasn't the only one struggling with these kinds of feelings, and that they could understand what I said. They accepted me. I didn't feel judged or being evaluated mm-hmm. to figure out what else is wrong with me. And that was crucial. And eventually from there, I went into a Buddhist meditation practice that did involve journaling, and worked with a teacher, which further helped me to develop the kindness and compassion to myself, mm-hmm. And to learn how to be heard and validated, and to get over some of the black and white thinking that I wasn't aware that I was doing. Mm-hmm. Just developing awareness and developing acceptance and kindness and compassion, not only to myself but to others, I mean, that is huge, because it has come into huge advantage in working with other peers. Absolutely. I have friends that is voice hearer. I have friends that are bipolar. I mean, and I find these people some of the most fascinating people that you will find on the earth.
Well, and it's interesting, Bonnie, because I do find that my most interesting friends are my friends who struggle with the greatest amount of external energies that we call them. You know, neurosis is almost a beautiful thing because it means that we are highly attuned to all of the intricacies of the world, the messiness of life. And I guess that's why I always go back to this. What if we change the way we looked at our mental health, and that those who are more highly sensitized, instead of labeling them as sick, we said they are more connected to the world, and that we should listen a little bit more closely. And I appreciate you bringing up the healing path, because you connected two things that I feel strongly about. One is that we need to find our community, that isolation is not healing, that we have to get out and find people that help normalize our experience, and that the path to healing isn't short, that getting into a Buddhist practice is not a 1 week or 2 week. It's a years long experience. So I appreciate you calling in and sharing your words. Thank you, Bonnie.
Oh, you're welcome. And I just wanted to add that there is a peer group that people can get involved with, and it's called Peer Advocacy and Advisory Team, and it's through TEMA, Transitions Mental Health.
All right.
And that has really helped me develop. I mean, I'm on several committees. I go to conferences on mental health. It's been really given me a lot of purpose in my life. I've done public speaking, and I feel that has also contributed greatly to my recovery.
Fabulous. Bonnie, thank you. And there is that piece that we have to somehow step up and take life back into our own control in any way that we can. So, Bonnie, thank you for that. 805-781-3875. David, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi, I just wanted to thank you. If I can get through this, I'm kind of a weepy guy. But anyway, I wanted to thank you for bringing, again, this to light. I've heard this concept recently in the last couple of months on several talk shows. Again, thank God for NPR.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been dealing with it probably since around 2008, when I started to lose my parents.
Mm-hmm.
And family members and divorce, all, you know, everything just kind of piled up on me by around 2010-11. I was a wreck.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
Never been one. I did some therapy, you know, a little bit with some family counseling type of stuff, marriage counseling. 30-year marriage went by the wayside.
It was a lot.
Anyway, you know, I was never one to take pharmaceuticals to deal with my depression.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I looked at other ways of doing it. I found a couple of, you know, homeopathic. One was barrage oil. I met a gal at the Dinosaur Caves that does homeopathic medicines and is an organic farmer, and she had a brochure on barrage, you know, the flower. And then I found out about barrage oil, you know, and that was kind of something that helped me relax and get some sleep at night.
Mm-hmm.
But I just want to, I'm so appreciative of you for bringing this to light again on this radio station and to the county here and whoever else you can reach out to. But, you know, I was always, you know, cautious about being prescribed any kind of depression mm-hmm. medication, you know, and felt again that this is something that I had to deal with mm-hmm. and work through, you know,
well,
on my own, and try to figure out what's going on. And even as a Christian, the Western Christian world view of depression is almost like, you know, in some sects, is almost like, you know, you have a demonic possession, you know. And I'm like, no, that's not true. What's happening in my life is what's causing me to be depressed because I can't fix it.
Right.
Guys need to. You know, I'm sorry.
Oops.
I'm sorry. You know.
Well,
thank you again very much for bringing this to light.
Thank you, David. I appreciate you calling. And I just want to kind of branch off of that what you're talking about is, you know, there's so many levels. I wish we could have talked the whole hour, that men experience depression differently than women do. That men tend to not have the feelings emotion part, but there can be a lot of anger or irritability or frustration, and this feeling that we need to fix things, and the fact that I can't fix things makes me feel helpless or less of a man, which makes me feel angry, and then I feel depressed. And so all of what you're talking about is normal. They're normal reactions. And the other part is that you had a lot of things things happen at one time, and you named it. You had a stress buildup, a trauma buildup in your life over a period of years, and it would not be abnormal to sink into a dark place for many years. You know, if you look at writings back hundreds of years ago, writers would talk about going into this dark underworld for 4, 5, 6 years of kind of exploring and having to reinvent themselves. But as Neil Burton talks about, we're in a society that doesn't have time, doesn't take the time to really go into the suffering and find our way through. We want to be done in 6 weeks. We don't have the sick pay to get off work. You know, the modern world has not left us time to heal psychically. So as a result, our psychic lives are in turmoil for long periods of time. So quickly, Renee, we only have a minute or so left, but I wanted to make sure we got to you.
Okay. Yeah, I have suffered from depression pretty much my whole adult life. Mm-hmm. And the things that I've learned in the last 5 or so years reading books on the brain is that the brain is changes based on your experiences. Mm-hmm. So if you have traumatic experiences, it's actually making circuits in your brain that take a long while to be rewired. So it's almost like you have to think and connect thoughts to connect different brain patterns so that you can rework the brain, because the brain wants to go down the old paths and remember the old things that are painful. And so the depression, you might get some antidepressants and it will help a little bit, but really rewiring the brain and rewiring the way you think about yourself and other people and how you have experienced life is for a lot of people what needs to be done. And it's not easy. It takes a lot of time because you're rewiring the brain. And especially with things that happen pre-five-year-old, you're talking about things that are part of who they are, part of the original person that they were.
Absolutely. And Renee, I am so glad you brought that up. It's a great way to wrap the show up, because the healing is in changing the circuitry of the brain. So not to dismiss that things haven't changed. It's the thoughts, it's the patterns, it's the experiences. And I wish we had another hour, because I'd love to talk about some of the work that actually is being done utilizing LSD and mushrooms and ecstasy, MDMA, and in ways to kind of rewire the brain instantly, to reshock it into a new wiring. Like, those are the things that we should be talking about, not the symptom, you know, not trying to just diminish symptoms, but actually reshocking the brain back to a new normal so that people can start building new memories and new experiences in a healthy way. Because childhood trauma.
Also had done some studies in LA, I think, about magnets, how magnets can help to heal depression by the use of pulling different the brain in different directions, and it has cured some people of depression.
Exactly, and I think there are a lot of paths we can go, but we have to let go of this one main path we're on that's not helping us before we can open up new paths. And so, as always, I appreciate you supporting this show and Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. Please visit me on our Facebook page. If you wonder why I'm the Reluctant Therapist, check out my website, thereluctanttherapist.com. You can also send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. I look forward to continuing this conversation and hearing from you again next Tuesday at 2. And as always, thank you for supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Elizabeth Barrett.
Here comes the sun, I say, it's all right.